Okay, on the 11th anniversary of the U.S.-sponsored U.N. sanctions against Iraq, newly declassified documents show the U.S. government intentionally used sanctions against Iraq to degrade that country's water supply after the Gulf War. Thomas Nagy, author of the cover story, The Secret Behind the Sanctions, How the U.S. Intentionally Destroyed Iraq's Water Supply, that appears in the September issue of Progressive magazine, cites seven partially declassified Pentagon documents dating back to 1991 to make his case. This morning, we're going to be talking with Rania Masri about the significance and implications of those documents. Lebanese by birth, Rania has been one of the leading opponents of America's sanctions policy and has tried to raise the awareness and the conscience of Americans about the devastation that the sanctions have brought to the Iraqi people. Welcome, Rania. Did you hear the introduction I made?
Yes, I did.
Okay, what are the implications and significance of this new report that the United States deliberately targeted the infrastructure, the water system, which is the basis of any society, as opposed to it being collateral damage?
Well, the implications are quite strong. First, let me state that this report was written by the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency back in January 1991, approximately 1 week after the bombardment of Iraq began. And this report states quite clearly that they knew what the consequences of the bombardment of Iraq's water treatment capacities would be. The report goes on further, and it even states that once these water treatment facilities are bombed, with 6 months of sanctions, they could be completely degraded. And they knew that no other solution exists except the rebuilding of the wastewater treatment facilities. Now, what is important to point out is not only did they deliberately bomb the wastewater treatment facilities in Iraq in 91, and know that 6 months would result in the degradation of the wastewater treatment facilities, but they have imposed sanctions for 11 years on the rebuilding of the wastewater treatment facilities, and not merely 6 months. And therefore, when we look at the UN reports and recognize that dirty water is the leading cause of child mortality, then this fact and these documents from the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency become all the more murderous.
Well, actually, and there's ample evidence in other countries throughout the world that contaminated water supplies leads to the high rates of child mortality. We only have to go south of the border to Mexico to see that.
Yeah.
In this situation, what way can this be brought to the American people? I mean, we have them wringing their hands in Washington, saying this is all Saddam Hussein's fault. How can this be brought and raised before a Congress that is kind of wedded to a sanctions policy?
Well, first of all, we as Americans need to recognize exactly what the policy is. We need to understand that very well, and then we need to be working with the congressional representatives that oppose this policy. Now, what this is a policy that is built on two things, bombing and sanctions. They go hand in hand. And so in 1991, we had the deliberate bombardment of Iraq's civilian infrastructure in violation of the Geneva Convention, in violation of the rules of war, including our own rules of war, complete violation of that. The destruction of Iraq's civilian infrastructure therefore made Iraq all the weaker and all the more needing to have the sanctions lifted. But with the sanctions imposed, or reimposed actually, Iraq was not allowed to rebuild this basic infrastructure, nor was it allowed to import very basic needs such as agricultural supplies and food seeds. So consequently, we have had, as the UN has reported, more than 500,000 children under the age of 5 in Iraq killed because of these sanctions. That's more than 500,000 children. This is more than all the children that have been killed by both the atomic bombs of Hiroshima and Nagasaki combined. So this is basically a silent nuclear bomb that is being dropped daily on Iraq as we speak. And no matter what we may think of the Iraqi regime, no matter how horrendous and how dictatorial the Iraqi regime is, destroying the country as a country and killing the people as a people only makes us equivalent to that regime. It puts us on the same level.
And this crime of destroying the water supply is something spelled out as a war crime in the Geneva Convention. Isn't that correct?
Yes, that is correct. Definitely that is correct.
And two UN officials who were in charge of overseeing the food for oil, this kind of operation that makes people in America believe that actually the Iraqi people are getting served, have resigned. Isn't that correct?
That is correct. Dennis Halliday, who was the assistant to the UN Secretary General and who served for 13 months as the first coordinator of the All for Food deal in Iraq, resigned, and his successor, Hans von Sponeck, also resigned. Both of these gentlemen resigned in protest to the sanctions and in protest to what they considered to be acts of genocide. Notice that we are no longer calling this acts of war crimes, but an act of genocide, wherein the destruction of the entire people as a people is the intention.
Getting back to the origins of the Iraq War, there are some observers, among them myself, who believe that the whole war was actually contrived in Washington to make use of kind of illusions on the part of Saddam Hussein that he, who had been a partner, in fact, had been armed by the U.S. for an attack on Iran following the Iranian Revolution, was actually our buddy, and that he had complained to the U.S. ambassador that prior to the invasion of Iraq, that Kuwait was doing slant drilling, that is, slant drilling into Iraqi oil supplies. Perhaps you could get into that a bit.
Yes, actually, before the invasion of Kuwait, Iraq sent three letters of protest to the United Nations in which it called the Kuwaiti actions acts of economic warfare. These are very, very strong terms, and unfortunately, there was no aspect of international diplomacy being mediated between Iraq and Kuwait at that time, which would have been the perfect time to stop any upending invasion or anything to come. It was back in 1990, in mid-1990. Now, what happened as a consequence was there were negotiations between Iraq and Kuwait, primarily to stop Iraq's slant drilling into Iraqi, to stop Kuwait's slant drilling into Iraqi territory, and to stop Kuwait from selling oil at a much lower price than was agreed upon by OPEC, which is extremely destructive for Iraq that was just coming out of a war. The negotiations halted very suddenly. Kuwait backtracked, and then we had the invasion of Kuwait by the Iraqi forces. Before the invasion, the Iraqi president met with U.S. Ambassador April Gillespie at that time and basically told her what was going to happen and asked her if the U.S. would interfere in border disputes between Iraq and Kuwait, and she responded that this was an Arab problem. So one could look at all that and could say Iraq fell into a trap or Iraq was being very naive. However, one can also step beyond and recognize that there was a Carter Doctrine that stated that Gulf interests are U.S. interests, basically that no country in the world has the right to control their own resources because we as Americans have the right to control everyone's resources. It's blatant hegemony and blatant imperialism to the full front. It's quite unfortunate that we had this invasion, and it has been even more destructive that we've had 11 years of war against the 22 million completely innocent people of Iraq.
Now, given that these documents have come out and reveal what the ultimate goal was to destroy what was probably a country with the highest standard of living in the Middle East, or at least close to that of Israel for many of the Iraqis, was and is, do you believe, the United States' goal is to get rid of Saddam Hussein or to maintain him in power?
I don't really know, and I think with this it would simply become an either-or. Perhaps the United States does want to keep Saddam Hussein in power because so long as he is in power, the United States has a boogeyman to continue to sell weapons of mass destruction. In other words, right now the military-industrial complex is making approximately $40 billion a year in the sale of weapons to the Arab countries, primarily the Arab Gulf countries, and of course the sale of weapons to Israel. And the creation of a monster in the persona of Saddam Hussein greatly helps in the sale of these weapons. Furthermore, so long as there is this creation of a monster, the American military bases can continue to remain on Arab soil, specifically in Saudi Arabia, in Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, in Bahrain, and they can continue to grow. So perhaps there is there is legitimacy in that. However, one can also look at the other side and say perhaps it would also be beneficial to remove the Iraqi dictator and have him replaced by another dictator. Now, we have to keep in mind that a democratic Iraq is not what the U.S. administration wants. The U.S. administration has stated that it wants a military coup, basically another dictator, very similar to how the U.S. led the coup against democratically elected President Salvador Allende in Chile and had him replaced by a dictatorial General Pinochet. regardless of the human rights violations that Pinochet conducted. So in that sense, perhaps they do want another dictator in Iraq who would open up Iraqi oil reserves to American companies and open up Iraqi resources to American companies. So there is benefit either way for the economic elite in the United States. But for the average American, the average middle class, the average lower income class American, either policy is extremely destructive to us, I would say, primarily because maintaining this policy on Iraq, maintaining this level of, quote, containment and this 11 years of war is costing American taxpayers a great deal of money. It is increasing resentment against Americans overseas, and it is also shifting the discourse in the United States away from the issues that it should be, away from issues of immediate social welfare and immediate needs for Americans here in the U.S. So in a way, this policy serves a double-edged sword. It kills Iraqis. At the same time, it kills lower-income Americans, all the while benefiting the economic elite in this country.
Because, of course, they keep building up and building up a military budget that's now over $310 billion and threatening to rise. And obviously, having a bogeyman like Saddam is used, as in the past, I believe, we used Gaddafi.
Yes.
And we used Khomeini in Iran. We need, I guess, an enemy figure to divert the American public's attention from what needs to be done here at home.
Exactly.
There's a lot of confusion been circulated in the mainstream media about the recent effort of the United States to modify the sanctions. Perhaps you can go into that.
Yes. Well, the so-called smart sanctions is a very powerful public relations ploy that the United States and the United Kingdom have been playing, presenting them as an alleviation of the humanitarian consequences of the sanctions. And they're a complete farce. And I say they're a complete farce because by looking at them in detail, we recognize that first and foremost, these so-called smart sanctions speak of the permanence of sanctions on the people of Iraq. There is no talk of when they would be removed, nor any talk of what the Iraqi government would need to do in order to lift this imprisonment of their people. So again, this is a permanence of this policy. In addition, smart sanctions actually strengthen the sanctions regime and not weaken it in any way. The borders around Iraq will be intensified, will be militarized by the United States, and therefore the Iraqi people will lose the little bit of cash that they are allowed in via these porous borders, which will be destructive to them. The third point is with regards to the hold. Now, currently, the United States has a great deal of items on hold. Let me explain this briefly. The oil for food deal allows Iraq to sell a portion of its oil resources up to a certain amount of money. All this money is held in a UN escrow account, all of it. Only 66% of it is then allocated back to the Iraqi people. Now, from the 66%, the Iraqi government has to apply for contracts. It has to apply, let's say, for rice or for insulin or for pencils. And the Security Council or the 661 Committee of the Security Council has to approve these contracts each and every time. And the United States has a great deal of these contracts on hold. Now, these smart sanctions talk about lifting the hold policy, but what that really means is that instead of the United States placing them on hold, they would flat out reject them. And we have to recognize also that this oil for food deal, which is talked about as being a humanitarian savior, is also a very powerful public relations ploy. The oil for food deal, Iraq has sold approximately $40 billion worth of oil since 1996, which for a country of 22 million people is a very small amount. But nevertheless, from these $40 billion worth of oil, only $12 billion has actually been allocated back to the Iraqi people. In other words, they have only seen $12 billion of the $40 billion that they themselves have sold. And this is the oil for food deal. And the smart sanctions will only make the problem even worse.
Now, I referred earlier to the standard of living in Iraq before the Gulf War. Perhaps you could comment on that and what these sanctions have done to that.
Yes, well, let me tell you what a UN report published in 1999 speaks of this, and I am quoting here. This UN report states, Iraq has experienced a shift from relative affluence to massive poverty, in marked contrast to the prevailing situation prior to the events of 1990, The infant mortality rates in Iraq today are among the highest in the world. Low infant birth weight affects at least 23% of all births. Chronic malnutrition affects every fourth child under 5 years of age. Only 41% of the population have regular access to clean water. 83% of all schools need substantial repairs. The Iraqi healthcare system today is in a decrepit state, and it would take $7 billion U.S. dollars to rehabilitate the power sector community worldwide, I mean, in the whole country. So it basically paints a picture of a complete devastation of a country from first world economic status back to the Stone Age, basically, where clean water has become a luxury, where the majority of children suffer from extreme malnutrition. Now, when we are talking about chronic malnutrition, that means that these children will become retarded, either physically, mentally, or emotionally. This is medically speaking. And every fourth child in Iraq is chronically malnourished. So imagine what this will do to this generation, what this will do to Iraq in the future.
And, of course, hardly any of this information gets into the mainstream media. Yes. Even another aspect is the U.S. and British bombing of so-called no-fly zones, which is not sanctioned by the United Nations. But I noticed, like, last week, even though no British or American plane has been hit by any Iraqi missile, even the locking on of radar is enough justification for so-called, for the U.S. or the British, let's call it mainly the U.S., to do the attacking. And the illusion that has been presented to the American people, even repeated on Berkeley Station KPFA News the other day, that these no-fly zones were there to protect the Kurds in the north and the Shia in the south. Do you accept that reasoning?
No, not at all. Not at all. These no-fly zones are a U.S. unilateral objective. They are not U.N. sanctioned. Actually, both U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan and U.N. Secretary General Boutros Ghali before Kofi Annan have stated quite clearly that there is no U.N. Security Council resolution that gives approval for these no-fly zones, nor are these no-fly zones sanctioned by the U.N. Charter. So they are a violation of these no-fly zones are a violation of...
Hello?
Hello, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know what just happened there.
Yeah.
So they're illegal. Of that, the bombings that occur by the U.S. and by the U.K. actually kill Kurds and Shiites, as well as other Iraqis. So this element of we are protecting you while we are killing you either, you know, also talks of further ludicrousy. The third point is that Iraq has the legitimate right to defend its airspace. Legally speaking, it has the legitimate right to defend its airspace, and therefore even the legitimate right to down any of these planes that violate its airspace. So it is actually the U.S. and the U.K. that are the aggressor here, completely in every shape of the word, and we need to recognize that as it is. And I have to say, I think that one of the main reasons that the mainstream media does not speak about the consequences of the bombing or the consequences of the continuing sanctions is because that they are Iraqis who are dying. They are Arabs who are dying. And the death of Arabs, as are the deaths of any minority in this country, are considered not newsworthy. It is not considered news when Arabs die. There is such an element of racism inherent in this policy that it is sickening.
Well, it's interesting that the United States is very willing for the Turkish government to kill the Kurdish people of Turkey.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And for the Israelis to bomb when they bomb in Lebanon, invade in Lebanon,
yes,
to kill the Shia of southern Lebanon. So these contradictions, I know, are never pointed up in the mainstream media. One little piece of history which most people have forgotten here, if they remembered it at all, was the incident that pushed Congress and the Senate to vote for going to war against Iraq. Was an incident in which a young Kuwaiti woman appeared in a caucus in Congress announcing she had come from Kuwait and that she had witnessed with her own eyes Iraqi soldiers throwing about 100 babies out of incubators to take these incubators back to Kuwait. That was arranged by a congressman from San Francisco, Tom Lantos, in cooperation with the Hill & Knowlton Public Relations Company, and it turned out that that young woman had not come from Kuwait, but was the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador. Is that story still circulating, or has that been pretty much forgotten?
That story, unfortunately, has been pretty much forgotten, as have numerous other stories that erupted in 1991 and since. It seems that stories that remind us that we are not living in a community in which free speech is rampant, in which we get the true essence of the information, are stories that we try to forget as Americans, and they are stories that we must remember, especially when the representatives and the senators are still in office. Tom Lantos committed a crime. He knowingly utilized a witness that he knew was speaking lies, that was speaking falsities, at a time when it was critical for foreign policy, critical for Americans and critical for Iraqis. And he employed deceit in order to get a vote. And it is shameful that the man is still in office.
By the way, Tom Lantos on September 9th in San Francisco will be